The headlines this hour. Iran's leader says the Islamic Republic has constantly engaged in challenges with world powers since it has disrupted the equations of the hegemonic system. A much-anticipated report about the so-called Partygate scandal in the UK says the country's senior leadership must bear responsibility for this culture. And a UN official says that over 200 million people are facing acute hunger worldwide and attributes the crisis partly to the war in Ukraine. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that Iran has firmly stood against hostilities and enmities and continues to make progress. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with Iranian lawmakers. The leader said that Iran and world powers are engaged in constant challenges in various dimensions because the Islamic Republic's new model, which is the religious democracy, led to the disruption of the global hegemonic system. Ayatollah Khamenei also raised the alarm about the hostile stance of world powers and threats of those possessing atomic weapons against each other. He added that Europe is one of the most war-prone regions that witnesses increasing military provocations and war in its vicinity. Ayatollah Khamenei said such conditions, in addition to food shortages and an unprecedented spread of a disease, have made the situation more complicated for other countries. Political commentator Fuad Azadi believes the U.S. has seen substantial erosion in its hegemonic power because Iran has stood up to Washington's aggressive policies in the region.
So Iran has made sure that U.S. hegemony in Southwest Asia doesn't take root. Iran has been opposing U.S. aggressive policies in this part of the world. And that opposition that Iran has been engaging in has affected U.S. stance internationally, and it has contributed to the decline that we see in the United States. That has resulted in the fact that U.S. Has failed in its policies in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, no matter where, in Iran, no matter where you look, the U.S. has failed. And that failure in this part of the world, I think, has resulted in people realizing that the U.S. is no longer a hegemonic power.
It's time now for the news via this bulletin. The British Prime Minister is in hot water again over COVID lockdown breaking parties. Long-awaited official report blames Boris Johnson and his government for the Partygate culture. The report by Sue Gray, a senior civil servant, says the leadership and top officials must bear responsibility for violating COVID rules. The report probed 16 such events held at Whitehall and Downing Street, while the country was placed under strict lockdown in 2020 at the height of the pandemic. Moments after the report was published, Johnson, addressing Parliament, said he takes full responsibility for what had happened.
And I want to begin today by renewing my apology to the House, to the whole country, for the short lunchtime gathering on the 19th of June 2020 in the Cabinet Room, during which I stood at my place at the Cabinet table and for which I received a fixed penalty notice. And I also want to say, Mr. Speaker, above all, that I take full responsibility for everything that took place on my watch.
The Premier also said that he was humbled and learned his lesson, but he insisted he was surprised and disappointed over drink-fueled events. That is while new revelations show Johnson himself attended a booze-filled party at his office, adding to the calls for him to resign. The opposition Labour Party leader has lashed out at the Prime Minister. Keir Starmer says the report would stand as a monument to the, quote, hubris and arrogance of Johnson's government. He censured the government for flouting the COVID lockdown rules. Rob Carter is a correspondent joining us from London to give us the latest, and we also have Lembit Opik, former UK Member of Parliament, joining us from London also. Welcome to you both, Rob Carter. So, we've seen what the report's findings are, and we've seen the way Boris Johnson has reacted. Tell us about, or give us some highlights of that, and if you've had any chance to get some people's reactions on this.
Sure. Well, basically, Boris Johnson is in a very awkward position. There's no doubt about it. It's just the drip of these endless scandals really seem to be taking their toll now. Real pressure on the Prime Minister to basically resign as a result of these numerous parties, boozy parties that were conducted in Number 10, one of which, of course, was a birthday celebration. I think it was in June 2020. And this was a time when, obviously, the government was enforcing laws where the rest of us couldn't meet our friends and families, let alone do many other things. But, of course, it seems as if it is very true that it's one rule for the rest of us and another totally for this government. So very, very difficult position that the Prime Minister finds himself in. And basically, after the recent presser that just ended just moments ago, where the Prime Minister took, I think it was just a number of questions, maybe about 9 questions or so, before basically was refusing to, the point he was trying to make was that, look, he's apologized to the House and to the public, but ultimately he thinks that he could just be allowed to move on. And that's something which he hopes very much so will happen. But obviously his critics and the opposition are going to keep the spotlight on him and are going to pressure him, if not to resign, then to take some real meaningful measures to maybe hold some of his colleagues to account who were in attendance of those parties and some of which actually organized the boozy event.
Lepidopic, so what do you think should be done in this case in point? I mean, obviously he says this has all happened under my watch, so I'm the one responsible. But I don't believe, at least your opinion matters here, that that suffice. So how should Boris Johnson, you think, proceed?
Well, all the rules have been broken by Boris Johnson. Other still signed. That's the point that was made in Prime Minister's question today. He's the first Prime Minister to have been found guilty of a crime while he's been in office. So the normal rules don't seem to apply. What should happen is the following. First of all, the dog in the street knows that he knew there were parties. Let's not pretend. He can sue me if he wants to on that one, and let's see how far he gets. Secondly, there's massive resentment from millions of people around the country, including potentially me, because my mother died last July, and I only saw her at the end of her life. I didn't get to see her physically for a year and a half because of the very lockdown rules that Boris Johnson and his colleagues seem to have broken. I would say specifically, number one, there's still an inquiry to happen in Parliament, and it would be astounding if they accepted this, in my view, lame belief that Boris Johnson could stand with a glass in his hand, surrounded by bottles and people, and didn't realise it was a party. The second thing is, if people feel like it, they could go and they could appeal against the crimes that they've been accused of on the basis that if they broke lockdown, they can say, well, the Prime Minister did worse, and he looks like he did it more than once. So why should we have this on our records whenever it turns out that the Prime Minister had done much more than that and got away with it?
Well, Carter, sifting through some of the lines that Boris Johnson fed the public, whether it's in Parliament, not the public, but at Parliament and then in the presser, do you get the feeling that there may be somebody that's going to take the fall for him or somehow for him to be relieved of that guilty verdict that he's obviously so appropriately given to him?
Possibly. We'll have to wait and see how things develop. But one thing that Boris Johnson's administration is actually building a reputation for is not so much throwing people under the bus in order for them to get away with it, but it's actually protecting those who have been accused of corruption or sleaze or anything like that. So Boris Johnson is seen as kind of this overriding protector of corrupt individuals. And it's almost become like a the Tory party itself has just become a very stereotype of what critics of the Conservatives see them as, which is this kind of elitist club which treats themselves differently to the rest of the general public and has a kind of elitist mindset where they protect their own and not so much everyone else. That's basically what Boris Johnson has become known for, and it's quite possible that he will continue to do that. So we'll have to wait and see how things go. But one thing I want to make, one point I want to mention to our audience is that there is a real problem here, because not only is Boris Johnson's government heavily criticised and being condemned for all of these outrageous photos that are being leaked now. But actually, the opposition on the other side of the House also has its own problems in this regard. So Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, he also is being investigated for photos that were leaked of him, of himself also apparently attending parties which he shouldn't have been doing during the lockdown, where there, again, there were boos present. So we have a kind of institutional issue here, which seems to show that the whole of Westminster is facing a crisis of corruption, where they just seem to be treating themselves differently to everyone else. It's one rule for us and another for them. So it's very difficult when you have an opposition trying to pressure the government on this issue, when actually members of the opposition have also been potentially guilty of the same crimes.
Well, then you can't have Limpidopic, a government that's run the way it has, and then you have the opposition that is also under investigation at this point, standing accused of the same. So what kind of political atmosphere are we looking at when it comes to the UK?
The situation is paralysis in this country, I have to tell you. I think that the point Robert made is absolutely right. First of all, Keir Starmer had about 8 chances in Prime Minister's questions to cause Boris Johnson to resign. He did such a pathetic job of it that Boris Johnson was still in post. Tony Blair, whether you like him or not, would have got rid of Boris Johnson in PMQs. Secondly, as Robert said, it's pot calling the kettle black. It's obvious that Keir Starmer is guilty of exactly the offence that he said was enough for the Prime Minister to resign. And that wasn't being found guilty of breaking the law, but simply being investigated by the police. And Keir Starmer is being investigated by the police. So he hasn't really got any moral credibility on this at all. Where do we go from here? Well, I think, as Robert implied, the public is just disgusted by this. Many people don't actually care. But those who have lost loved ones, those who maybe have lost work, those who followed the rules faithfully when it hurt them. And remember, my mother died in this time as well. Those people are saying, how dare you behave like this as Prime Minister? We expected more. And here's a fundamental problem. If you lie to Parliament, you're expected to resign from your ministerial position. That applies to the Prime Minister as well. The only reason he's still there is because he claims he didn't know there was a party when he had been at one. There were bottles there, he was raising a toast, there were lots of people in the room, and he's so far got away with it. But you know what? The real court is going to be public opinion. Whether Boris can overcome this, I doubt. How long will the Tories give him to recover? Maximum 6 months. I heard that from a very senior Conservative. And if he hasn't pulled round their poll ratings, they're ruthless. They'll be gone by December.
Very well. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Limpidopic there, former UK Member of Parliament. And Rob Carter, thank you. Correspondent from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. The UNOfficial paints an extremely grim picture of the global food security, saying that over 200 million are facing acute hunger worldwide. Achim Steiner warns that soaring food prices could lead to civil unrest in many countries.
And this is obviously something that can quickly translate then into also political rupture. When people are not able to feed themselves, governments are not able to provide for food in the marketplace, then politics quickly moves onto the street. And this is something that is obviously of grave concern to many of us.
Steiner, who is administrator of the UN Development Program, made the remarks on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum's annual meeting at Davos. He attributed the current food insecurity partly to the war in Ukraine, saying that a large number of African and Arab countries heavily rely on wheat supplies from there. He added that the drought in East Africa will worsen the situation. Steiner also underlined that governments are becoming less and less capable of buying what he categorized as expensive food since the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic. According to the UN official, about 80 countries will likely be in debt distress this year. Russia says sanctions imposed on the country over its military operation in Ukraine should be immediately lifted in order to avert a global food crisis. The Deputy Foreign Minister Andrei Rudenko says a comprehensive approach is what is needed to resolve the food problems facing many countries. He called for the removal of the restrictions on Russian exports and financial transactions. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine in February, the U.S. and its European allies have been spearheading punitive measures against Russia. Russia and Ukraine are the major producers of several staple crops, including wheat and corn. But sanctions, coupled with the ongoing conflict, have disrupted supplies of food commodities. U.S. President Joe Biden has traveled to East Asia, his first trip there since taking office last year. Taking a U-turn on decades-old policy, Biden said that he would defend Taiwan militarily if it was attacked by China. Now, that prompted harsh reactions from Beijing, but war threats reveal that the U.S. is in no mood of pursuing a diplomatic path when it comes to China.
The sour relations between China and the U.S. are back on the front burner. The U.S. President Joe Biden has angered China by his belligerent remarks over Chinese Taipei. Biden said that he would be willing to use force to militarily defend Chinese Taipei if Beijing invades the self-ruled island. Biden made the remarks in Japan's capital, Tokyo. He accused China of, quote, flirting with danger by flying so close to Chinese Taipei. He promised Washington would defend the island from any military action by its giant neighbor. The blunt remarks by Biden have been interpreted as raising tensions with China. Many past American presidents would have deflected, demurred, or declined to give a straight answer.
Well, in this case, the U.S. is trying to test the ground with China. It's trying to provoke and see the reaction. This is why you have first Joe Biden saying something, and then you have the White House saying the opposite. And they keep on doing that over and over. So they're trying to test the red light of China.
One possible reason could be that the U.S., under Biden, has abandoned its strategic ambiguity over Taiwan. The aim of that policy had been to ward off China from taking military action without the U.S. committing itself to a war. The White House official said Biden's comments did not reflect the policy shift. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the U.S. refused to recognize it as the rightful government in China. Instead, the U.S. had an embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to establish formal ties in a bid to create a counterbalance to the Soviet Union. And at the start of 1979, the U.S. gave formal diplomatic recognition to the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. In doing so, Washington recognized the PRC as the sole legal government of China. It also acknowledged Beijing's position that there is only one China and that Taipei is a part of it. After the U.S. cut off formal relations with Taipei, Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act. It has underpinned U.S. ties toward the island ever since.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has held a military parade to mark the 22nd anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon from Israeli occupation. Hezbollah fighters paraded in Baalbek City in the country's eastern Baqa Valley. Lebanon marks the Resistance and Liberation Day on May 25th each year. Hezbollah drove Israeli forces out of southern Lebanon in May 2000, ending over two decades of occupation. Since then, the resistance group has grown into a powerful military force, dealing repeated blows to the Israeli military, including during a 33-day war in 2006. The Hezbollah leader, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, will deliver a speech on the occasion later in the day.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
A vocal minority in the US are demanding not gun bans, but book bans, trying to suppress the teaching of the US deep-seated systematic racism. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan, writers. This article is published under the heading The Buffalo Massacre, Banning Books, and Systematic Racism. Stay tuned for more. Ten people were slaughtered in Buffalo recently, killed at a supermarket in the heart of the black community. The gunman, an 18-year-old self-professed white supremacist armed with a legally purchased Bushmaster AR-15 style semi-automatic rifle. His goal, based on rambling, poisonous 180-page document he posted online, was to kill as many blacks as possible. Of the 13 victims, including three who were injured, 11 were African-American. The killer live-streamed the massacre on the social media video website Twitch. While the Amazon-owned site pulled down the gruesome video within minutes, it was immediately posted, then accessed by millions on other internet platforms. Challenging racist violence demands an understanding of U.S. true history. Instead, a vocal minority in the U.S. are demanding not gun bans, but book bans, trying to suppress the teaching of U.S. deep-seated systematic racism. The Buffalo shooter espoused a conspiracy theory known as the Great Replacement, which wrongly posits that traditional native-born white majorities are being replaced by people of color, immigrants, and Muslims, aided and abetted by a left-wing globalist elite. This new population, the racist replacement theory maintains, compliantly votes according to the dictates of their supposed Democratic Party sponsors. The killer, who is in custody, directed his animus at replacers, as he called them, principally African Americans. His slapdash screed, which borrows heavily from another one posted by the racist mass murderer who perpetrated the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque massacres in 2019, betrays a profound ignorance of the history and racism in the United States of America. Abram X. Kendi, founding director of Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research, warned on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, this crisis of white supremacist domestic terror is likely to get worse. Studies have shown that anti-racist education, that anti-racist books serve in a protective fashion, particularly for white youth when they are exposed to white supremacy, because through learning about the history of white supremacy, they are better able to recognize it. Several of Kendi's books have been banned or targeted for removal from school curricula and libraries, including the National Book Award-winning Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Texas Senator Ted Cruz drove Kendi's children's book, Anti-Racist Baby, onto bestseller list after denouncing it and several other books during the Senate confirmation hearings of African-American Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Professor Kendi continued, anti-racist education, first and foremost, is teaching children about the history of white supremacist ideology, the role that white supremacist ideology played in racial slavery, in settler colonialism, in Jim Crow. It's teaching children U.S. racial reality so that they can see that, though Americans look different, though Americans maybe speak differently. They are all equals, but the cause of these inequities are indeed racism. The domestic terrorist in this case reportedly chose Buffalo after searching zip codes close to his overwhelmingly white hometown of Conkling, New York. He then traveled several hours to Buffalo's Kingsley neighborhood and targeted the Tops Friendly Market on Jefferson Avenue. Why the supermarket? India Walton, a former Buffalo mayoral candidate and senior strategic organizer with the progressive organization Roots Action, explained on Democracy Now! We know that 80% of the population of the east side of Buffalo are people of color, are black people specifically, and they have one place to shop. We have dubbed it food apartheid because it is a policy decision. The fact that there is no food on the east side of Buffalo and there is not the availability of these basic services is a policy choice. There are people who actively chose to not provide services in this community. For a long time, we've been told that this Tops on Jefferson, we are lucky to have it because no one else wants to come into the neighborhood. The Buffalo mass murderer also considered additional targets, either a church or a school. According to online chats attributed to him, he feared the school would have too much security. Fortunately, he was stopped at the supermarket. White supremacists are making the case that it's the people of color, that they're the source of their pain, which is something that many of these young white male supremacists are being indoctrinated on, groomed on, and thereby carrying out mass shootings. Ibram X. Kendi said, adding, "This is only going to get worse if we don't get a handle on it." Limiting access to guns and expanding access to education about the role of racism in the U.S. society and learning, as Ibram X. Kendi's book title suggests, how to be an anti-racist are fundamental steps to stem the horror of hate and heal these long festering wounds.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Today, brothers and sisters, inshallah, we're going to be addressing a very, very important spiritual disease. So, the disease you and I are going to talk about is one which is called in Arabic, Su'udhan. It's when we think badly of others. So now I want to give you a little bit of a case study for us to think about. In this first case study, brothers and sisters, there's a family, and the first thing that comes to their mind when anything happens, so this is inside a family, husband, wife, children, whenever anybody does anything in the first family, the assumption is the worst. There's always an angle. What are you trying to do? What did you mean by that? Imagine one family that's like that. We're going to talk about how that even if you're trying to repair a relationship, we'll talk about that later, that the imam explains that this stops us from being able to repair a relationship. Because now even if you do something kind, imagine a family like this. We're always on guard, always looking. What is it you're trying to do? What is your angle? Now we're trying to fix the relationship. The person wants to do something nice to me. Now I'm like, why? Hadith. We'll talk about that inshallah later. So that's the first family. The second family is one where the assumption is always the person was trying to do the right thing. The person comes in a little late from work. The wife would assume, must be working long hours. My husband's such a hero. My wife didn't help. This is inside our family. My wife didn't do the laundry. There's one time, the first family, she's trying to teach me a lesson. I'll show. Isn't it? Maybe she forgot. Every time there's a situation, it's a chance for more love with this first, the second family, right? So obviously, those two families, the experience they have in life is going to be very different. What the imam tells us, the next hadith, is that if you think good of people, this actually creates love. People love those who think good about them. Right? Or as opposed to those who are, you have to always, everything you say, you have to, what does the person mean? What are they trying to say? Hadith says this, man hasuna dhannahu bin nas. The person who thinks good of others, haza minhum al-mahabba. This person, Imam Ali says, he gets the love of others. If you think about it, this is what those who love one another do. If you really care about somebody, if you like someone, if you think that that person's a good person, when a mistake happens, you automatically assume that they're trying to do the right thing. There was a man named Shaqiq. Shaqiq. And Shaqiq says, one year I went to make Hajj. He says, when I went to make Hajj, you know, there in the good old days, back in the old days, there were areas where you would stop in and then you would travel along the way to Hajj. So he says, I went to one of these rest stops where everybody was, everybody's dressed up, everybody's getting ready for Hajj. And he said, I saw one youth who was very handsome. Obviously, face full of nur. This person, he mentions, he was brown, very handsome. He says, thin. And he was off in the distance from everybody else. So everybody's getting ready to move to Hajj. This person is sitting off in the distance. And he says he was wearing a woolen cloak. A woolen cloak. In my mind, Shaqiq says, in my mind, when I saw this person, I said to myself, this person is definitely a Sufi. He wants to go to Hajj, and he wants to be a burden on all the other Hujjaj. He thinks he's so pious, he's worshiping, he's going to be over here, he's going to go in the caravan, and he's not going to do his responsibility. He's going to be busy with work because he's avoiding everybody. He has so much nur in his face. This person has a problem. He said, in my mind, I made a decision to go over and to warn him about this terrible behavior. And he said, I went over to him, and when I went over to him, then he turned to me without me saying anything. So I'm walking to this youth who I see off in the distance. Without me saying anything, he turned to me and he said, Shaqiq, ijtanibu kathiran min adhan, inna ba'd adhan ith. Shaqiq, he called me by my own name. He said, avoid much suspicion. Surely some suspicion is sin. He said, when he called me by my name, I said, oh, this is somebody a little bit different. He just read my mind. He said the appropriate verse. I didn't even get up to him. I just thought something. He said, this is one of Allah's awliya. He said, I wanted to walk up to him, but he got up, he left. I didn't see him. He disappeared amongst the crowd. He said, so we continued, and as they were going towards Hajj, there were different places that they would stop. At another one of these rest stops, he saw this person, and he saw him over there in a corner praying. This same special person, the Nurani, he saw them over there in a corner praying. And he says, the prayer of this person, limbs shivering out of fear of Allah, crying tears. He said, I thought badly of him. I want to ask for forgiveness. He said, I started going over to get to the person to ask for forgiveness. Why is it I thought badly of you? And there, before I got a chance to speak, again, he told me, Shaheed. He said, he quoted a verse, وَإِنِّي لَغَفَارٌ لِمَنْ تَابَ وَآمَنَ وَعَمِلَ صَالِحًا ثُمَّ اهْتَدَى. He quoted another verse of the Quran, that I certainly am forgiving of the person who makes tawbah and has faith, iman, and does good deeds, and then is guided. He quoted another verse of Quran. So, been forgiven. And then again, I don't catch up to him, he leaves. He says, so, we continue on the trip to Hajj. He says, we come to another rest stop. And in this rest stop, I see him off in the distance. And what happens is, I'm looking at this youth. He's off in the distance. And what happens is, he's by a well. And he has a bucket. And he's trying to get water, to bring water up from the well. And when the bucket slips out of his hand, it goes down into the water. He looks up at heaven. And then he starts addressing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that you are my Lord. When I'm thirsty, you provide me with water. When I'm hungry, you provide me with food. Oh Allah, I don't have anything other than this bucket. Please bring this bucket back for me. Don't take this bucket. He said, don't take this bucket away from me. He said, and then I saw with my own two eyes, the water in the well rose until the bucket came up. The person took the bucket, made wudu. So he's like, who is this? One of Allah's awliya. Again, he wasn't. Later on, he sees this person. Now when he sees the person, he's at the Kaaba. He's at the Kaaba, crying. He describes how the person is. He says, and now when the person leaves the Kaaba, I notice there's people walking with him, people trying to say salams to him, perhaps getting tabarruk from him. I ask, who is that person? They said, that's Musa ibn Ja'far. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far. So what happens is, if thinking badly of others is not kept under control, it can get to the stage where I might assume something bad about someone who's excellent, even an imam. So this gives us a little bit of an idea of how serious this is. Inshallah, later on, if Allah gives tawfiq, we'll try and talk a little bit about some solutions and how to make sure that we don't have this trait.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
There are longer-term solutions to solving the world's ongoing refugee crises, such as addressing the root causes that endanger people's lives and livelihoods. But a fundamental principle of any morally functioning government is to uphold the human rights of people to seek safety, and not shift that responsibility to states with less developed asylum systems. Here we present you an article in this regard, written by Joshua Surtees, a journalist and former writer for UNHCR, under the heading, "Rich Britain Sending Refugees to Rwanda Isn't Burden Sharing, It's Shameful Exploitation." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Joshua Surtees wrote, "In my time working for the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, a stark fact was often mentioned. The vast majority of the world's displaced people are hosted by the world's poorest countries. Today, 85% of the refugees live in developing countries, while the richest nations host just 15%. While Rwanda might be developing economically, it is still among the world's 25 poorest countries. The UK is among the world's 10 richest countries. To acknowledge the disparity of wealth between the two nations and decide that Rwanda is better able to accommodate people attempting the treacherous journey across the channel takes a huge leap of the imagination." The deal announced by UK Home Secretary Priti Patel in Kigali on Thursday, April 14th, demonstrates the government's tenacious commitment to positioning Britain as a country that is close to the world and to those who need its sanctuary the most. There has been a great deal of political debate and condemnation since the policy was announced, and the government arranged for the arrival in Rwanda of the British media it thought best placed to help it trumpet this maneuver in time for the local elections. But there are still questions we must ask to ascertain whether this is a cynical ploy or a thought-through policy. Joshua Surtees said, "Is it because Rwanda has more geographic capacity, perhaps? More free land or housing infrastructure? Is Britain really bursting at the seams? Rwanda's population density is almost double that of Britain's. It is a country almost twice as crowded as ours, yet, per capita, it already hosts five times as many refugees as the UK, as well as hosting Congolese and Burundian refugees. Rwanda has recently offered itself as a host country for the emergency evacuation of refugees trapped in dire conditions in Libya." In the introduction to the Home Office's Memorandum of Understanding with Rwanda, the UK boasts of having taken in 25,000 Syrian refugees as a way of demonstrating its long, proud history of providing protection to those who need it. This claim is laughable. More than 6 million Syrians have fled their country in the 11 years since war began. For much of the crisis, Lebanon hosted 2 million Syrians, representing a third of Lebanon's 6 million population. Bangladesh, one of the world's most densely populated countries, hosts close to 1 million Rohingya refugees from Myanmar. Poland is currently hosting 2.7 million Ukrainians. These figures put in context what it really means to protect those in need. The memorandum speaks of burden sharing during refugee crises. Rwanda, a country that has experienced its fair share of crises, is already shouldering its share of the burden. The UK comfortably has the capacity to take in people crossing the channel. It is neglecting its share of the burden while persuading Rwanda to carry more. How the Home Secretary managed to convince the Rwandan government to accept this arrangement may become apparent in due course. When Australia utilized the tiny island state of Nauru for a similar purpose, it gave aid in return. Australia, an immensely privileged country, effectively paid a less economically fortunate country to take desperate people off its hands, in some cases for years. The British government is callously copying the Australian playbook. While its PR agents in the press trumpet this coup as some kind of triumph, the Daily Mail's front page read, "Rwanda plan to smash the Channel gangs." The Daily Express said, "Bold plan to send both migrants to Rwanda," as though the Prime Minister had overseen a selfless act of reason, humanity, bravery, striking a blow for compassion, saving England from the scourge of people simply trying to escape death and poverty. When Boris Johnson referred in his speech on Thursday, April 14th, to people illegally entering the country, he was using the worst kind of semantics. Refugees fleeing the conflicts or persecution do not have the luxury of entering Britain legally. If they had the time and opportunity to apply for a UK visa, they would not, in essence, be refugees. Seeking asylum routinely involves entering a territory without prior permission. When UNHCR's Asia and Pacific Director, Enrica Ratawat, visited Nauru in 2018, he reported his shock at the immense toll that long-term detention had taken on people's mental health. Over 80% had been diagnosed with PTSD, trauma, and depression. He told the press the sense of hopelessness and despair was extremely tangible. In Greece, in 2020, asylum seekers living at Moria Reception Center on the island of Lesbos burnt it down in what was perceived by many as a protest at the poor conditions and dangerous levels of overcrowding. We should not automatically assume that Rwanda's model of hosting asylum seekers will follow that of Lesbos of Nauru. Indeed, there are some good news stories about refugee integration there. But Rwanda, which Johnson describes as one of the world's safest countries, is also a country that cannot provide an acceptable life conditions for its citizens because it is one of the world's poorest countries. What guarantees can we have that non-citizens will be well received? Rwanda has internal transit centers where people deemed undesirable, including beggars, are sent in order to keep the streets looking appealing for tourists attracted by the country's international marketing campaigns. Rwandans who oppose or criticize the government are liable to be informed on by neighbors, placed under surveillance, blackmailed, tortured, sent to rehabilitation camps, or even killed. Many Rwandans were forcibly returned to the country from refugee camps in neighboring countries in the years after the 1994 genocide. Many continue to risk their lives or liberty to trek through remote jungles to escape and flee to Uganda as refugees themselves. In reporting Patel and Johnson's plan, the Daily Telegraph said that migrants will be encouraged to settle in Rwanda. The agreement doesn't appear to give them much choice in the matter. Their options, should Rwanda not turn out to be a safe or sustainable place for them, will be somewhat limited. The memorandum says Rwanda will ensure that it will treat each relocated individual and process their claim for asylum in accordance with the Refugee Convention. But what about the UK's obligations to abide by the convention that it is a signatory to? What about that claimed long and proud history of protection? UNHCR, the organization designed to uphold the convention, has said it will delay its judgment on the legality of Patel's deal until its legal teams in Geneva have analyzed the details. Though, its position is clear. It said in a statement, UNHCR does not support the outsourcing of asylum states' obligations. There are longer-term solutions to solving the world's ongoing refugee crisis, such as addressing the root causes that endanger people's lives and livelihoods. But a fundamental principle of any morally functioning government is to uphold the human rights of people to seek safety, and not shift that responsibility to states with less developed asylum systems.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. According to one narration, too, the first Sariya that the Holy Prophet dispatched was led by Hazrat Hamza. He gave him a banner and sent him to battle. His role was also outstanding in the Battle of Badr. accompanied by the other two great personalities, and in the Battle of Uhud. Apparently, it was after the Battle of Badr, when one of the captives asked, "Who was the person who fought bravely with a sign or insignia?" Whenever Hazrat Hamza fought, he had a sign or insignia on his uniform. They answered, "Hamza ibn Abdul Muttalib." The captive replied, "He was the one who ruined us, and what happened to us was because of him. He destroyed the army of the unbelievers in the Battle of Badr. He was such a personality. Despite that, he is an unknown personality. He is not well known, and there are not good biographies about him and his qualities. He has not received due recognition."
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
May God show mercy on Mustafa Aqad, who portrayed that great personality in a magnificent work of art. It was really magnificent, especially the part about Hamza, named The Message. Well, the actor playing Hamza was really well-known and important. We should thank him again for making such a film. It is really interesting. He managed to portray the life of that great personality. To some extent, of course, such work should be done more. It should be done on the other companions of the Holy Prophet as well. It should be done on Ammar and Salman as well. As for Miqdad, who knows him? Who knows what he did? There is a narration about the first-tier companions of the Holy Prophet that says that only Miqdad did not change after the Holy Prophet's demise. These personalities are very important and they should be revived. The same is true of Ja'far ibn Abi Talib in particular, because the life of Ja'far has a great potential for artistic and dramatic work. His trip to Habasha, the things that happened there, and his return are great materials of artistic work.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.